Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with journalist, author, and columnist Joe Klein. Joe Klein is the author of 7 books, most recently Charlie Mike, A True Story of Heroes Who Brought Their Mission Home as Anonymous. Klein wrote the critically acclaimed novel Primary Colors, a bestseller inspired by the 1992 presidential race. Mr. Klein also published Woody Guthrie, A Life in 1980, and Payback, 5 Marines After Vietnam in 1984. Currently, Joe Klein is touring the region, most recently at the Mehewi Theater, with his talk on How on Earth Did We Get Here? The Chaotic Politics of 2016. We'll talk to him about all of this and more. But first, welcome, Joe Klein.
Oh, it's good to be here, Alan.
Well, first of all, we have to admit our failures, and I'm going to admit mine. One day, Mario Cuomo had his plane warmed up to fly Mike Del Judice to New Hampshire, where he would register him as the presumptive Democratic candidate for president of the United States. Well, I got my big chance, and they invited me to come on the Today Show. And who else was there but you? And the host, whoever that was, said, you were in the studio, I was up here, said, well, Professor, is he running or not? I said, of course he's running. And you said, I wouldn't be that quick to decide on it. So you were right, and I was wrong, and it really rankled me for years that I was wrong. Then one day I realized I couldn't blame you for being right. Get it?
Yes, I do. You know, it's funny, but the current governor, Andrew Cuomo, once said to me that I had a father and son-like relationship with Mario. And I guess he meant that was because we fought a lot. But Cuomo used to call me up. He would be in Albany. I would be in New York. We were both Knicks fans. And we would watch the basketball game simultaneously.
That's a riot.
With him screaming at me for the first half. And then us talking about sports for the second half. And I just really had a very good sense of who he was. The other reason why I kind of sensed that he might not do it was that at one point he went to Japan. I don't know whether you remember this. And he asked me if I wanted to come with him. And I said, no. And he said, why not? And I said, because I know you. I know what you're going to do. You're going to fly over there. You're going to check into the hotel. You're going to have meetings with the finance and commercial people to try and get business for the state. You're going to go back to the hotel, have dinner, and then you're going to get on a plane. And he said, yeah, you're probably right. I said, I want to do some sightseeing when I'm there. He said, yeah. I said, why are you like this? And he said, I guess it's because I grew up over a store. And the real reason was that he was kind of uncomfortable outside of the things he could control. You know, I couldn't imagine Mario in Iowa. You know, he would get so embarrassed if he mistook a pig for a cow or something like that. And I sensed that going out there and showing all that much of himself to the people was going to be something tough for him.
Well, you know, I had this radio show with him for, somewhere between 12 and 18 years. So we don't really know how long, but on every public radio station in New York. And I really got to know him, too. So I should have known what you knew, but I didn't. And that just shows that somehow you're just smarter and better than I am.
No, it just means that the novelist part of my brain was working.
So, Joe Klein, I guess I got to ask you the first thing. Primary Colors was a huge success for you. And, of course, there was a big brouhaha about why you didn't say you had written it in the beginning. How come?
Well, the true answer is that I was anonymous because of cowardice and whimsy. You know, every journalist thinks that they have a novel somewhere in their computer, if not exactly in their mind. And usually it's the results are embarrassing. And I didn't want to be embarrassed. But also, my wife and I are very big into 19th century English fiction, which was written in serial form and always using a pseudonym. Jane Austen never put her name on anything. It was Pride and Prejudice by a lady. And I thought that that was a really kind of cool tradition that might be fun to revive. And then as it became clear that this was really, something was really happening here, and it was somewhat beyond my control, I never knew what was going to happen next in the book. The characters were just taking off in their own directions. I decided that anonymity would be important because I wanted the book judged on its own merits rather than on my relationship with the Clintons or on my merits as a journalist, because fiction writing is something else entirely. So that was it.
Don't you find sometimes, though, Joe Klein, that fiction writing is closer to the truth than reporting?
Well, it's closer to the emotional truth. I mean, reporting is reporting. And sometimes when you're reporting something, someone will say something to you that is the emotional truth. But when you're writing fiction, to me, it's the exact opposite. When I do journalism, I do an awful lot of reporting. I've never been an armchair columnist. I've always been someone who had to go out and see things for myself. And I sit down and I'm pretty confident that I know what's going to, I have my lead, and then I panic. With fiction writing, and I'm writing a novel right now, it's the exact opposite. I'm panicked before I sit down. But then, on a good day, the characters start talking to each other, and I disappear. So it's the exact opposite.
So you're one of those guys who says, I sit down, basically, I don't have a real roadmap. It evolves, and it takes over, and I don't have that much to do with it.
Right. In fact, I once had a funny conversation with Bill Clinton about it, and it was the absolute truth. I said to him, the gimmick was going to be that Jack Stanton, who was kind of the Southern governor in primary colors, the gimmick was going to be that Jack Stanton was going to lose, but he just wouldn't. And he sent me a lovely note. And, it was the truth, because my conscious brain kept on throwing all kinds of crazy stuff at this character. And my subconscious brain always got him out of it. And he sent me a lovely note, which I still have, obviously, thanking my subconscious brain for being a little bit more tolerant of him than my conscious brain was.
You are a quintessential insider, of course, when it comes to the Clintons. So I want to ask you this question, because the New York Times has opined on this, everybody's opined on this. Why don't people like Hillary more?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. Part of it is that this woman has been subjected to the most relentless assault of any public figure in American history. It's been going on for, over 20 years now. And a lot of it is just outrageous stuff. Donald Trump is reminding us of that now. The idea that her best friend, Vince Foster, was murdered rather than committing suicide, which is obviously what happened. It's just the relentlessness of this attack. And, if you listen to Rush Limbaugh, as I do when I'm traveling through Iowa during the caucuses and things like that, there is this quality of, it's a form of extreme emotionalism about this. They cannot imagine why they can't beat the Clintons. And so they come up with every last crazy rumor possible. Everything she does in their minds is done for ulterior motives. So that's number one. Number two is that her reaction to this has been not always the best, but it also is very guarded. Unlike him.
Yeah, he'd meet it head on.
She doesn't show very much of herself.
Yeah, right.
He doesn't show very much of himself either, but he gives the appearance of showing a lot of himself.
I get it.
And, privately, I've known these folks for 30 years now. I've had more candid conversations with her privately than I've ever had with him. She's very open. She has a really cool, ironic sense of humor. And, you wonder, people always say this, you wonder why she can't project that publicly. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it is that she is really gun-shy at this point. The third thing about her is that she's made some really bad personal mistakes. Mm-hmm. I mean, this whole business with the Clinton Foundation, I think, is going to be a big problem for her in the fall. I cannot imagine why she made these Wall Street speeches. She says she wasn't sure she was going to run for president. That's nonsense. Everybody knew she was going to run for president.
Sure.
And so there really is some questionable behavior there and a sense of entitlement that because they're doing what they perceive to be God's work, then anyway, they need to get there. If they have to take a private plane to get there to do God's work, then that's okay.
So, Joe Klein, let me ask you this. Does this go to character? In other words, if you were a psychiatrist and looking at this, you talked about entitlement. Does this go to what her essential character is? This is a flaw?
Well, I think we're all flawed.
Well, no, yes, but some more than others. So when you talk about Whitewater and then this and that, do you get a pattern?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to put her on the couch. But I will say this, and this may be another factor that contributes to the way she's perceived. her real strengths aren't things that are obvious and public. Her real strengths are the ability to learn, to take apart issues and put them back together again in an acceptable way, to deal with problems based on, you know, her knowledge of a lifetime of caring about this stuff, and her ability to come up with compromise answers. Now, those are all the kind of things that, you know, the wonky side of me loves about her, but it's not easy, you know, for her to show that publicly. Do you want me to give you an example?
Sure. Of how?
Okay. You know, I thought I had retired. I was the New Yorker's Washington correspondent, and I retired after my seventh presidential campaign in 2000. I retired for 8 months and 11 days, and on the 12th day of the ninth month, I realized I had to get back to work because nine of my neighbors hadn't come home that night. You know, there had been the terrorist attacks. And just about the same time, she was elected to the Senate from New York, and she got on the Armed Services Committee after a couple of years in office. And I felt that I had to learn the military at that point, and she certainly had to learn the military at that point, and I watched her learn the military. And in fact, you know, we realized after a while that we were both seeking out the same kind of people, military intellectuals like David Petraeus. And at one point I was at Fort Leavenworth, where Petraeus was putting together his counterinsurgency manual. Because, you know, I think I was probably the first columnist to say, hey, maybe we should try this, because nothing else had worked, and he invited me out there to study. So we're having dinner one night. Petraeus has a single margarita, and he's surrounded by, you know, his aides, who are among the drop-dead smartest people I've ever met. And I ask him, is there anyone in the Democratic Party who might be president who has the vaguest idea of how your mind works? And he smiled and he said, you mean aside from Hillary?
Interesting.
By the way, the uniformed military feels that way in the upper ranks. They feel that way about her because they feel that she really made the effort to understand their problems and what they were doing.
Now, the Bernieites, of course, see Hillary as, you know, basically establishment. And that's what many of them don't like about her. And in fact, I get telephone calls here on our Vox Pop program. They get quite rabid after a while. Is that part of it, the establishment issue?
Well, yeah, I think, of course. I mean, I've written that she's kind of playing the role that George H.W. Bush played in 1992. You know, she is the establishment candidate this year. A good part of it is, you know, the downside of it is the fundraising and relationship with Wall Street that exists. And I think that the Bernie people and Bernie are absolutely right to question that. But on the other hand, I don't think Bernie's answers work. You know, I've been around a long time, and I started, you know, marching against the war, marching for civil rights in the 60s. But I also was also behind the Iron Curtain when socialism was attempted, and I saw how that worked. And finally, I really believe that if Democrats, liberals, progressives, whatever you want to call people on the left side of the spectrum, are going to advocate for a more active government, they also have to be advocating for government reform. You cannot have a government where there's no accountability. What happens is that you get the Veterans Administration. Things don't work. If you cannot fire people, then you cannot have effective governance. And Bernie's people, you never hear Bernie talk about the need to reform government. In fact, you barely hear Hillary talk about it. And I think that one of the things that the American people are really sick of is big government, as sick of big government as they are of big business.
So do you think that makes, Joe Klein, do you think that makes for a similar path for both the people who are voting for Trump right now and the people who are voting for Bernie? In other words, they're both anti-establishment.
Oh, yes. Or they style themselves as being anti-establishment.
Yes.
But I think that there's something else going on here. And, you know, there are two things that politicians always say when they're making speeches. And I began my career in Peabody, Massachusetts, covering the city council. And, you know, I remember going to hearings about canine control, and once hearing a city councilor saying, we are at a crossroads in the history of canine control in PVD, Massachusetts. There has never been an election that I covered where one candidate or another didn't say, we're at a crossroads at the, you know, in the history of this or that. So imagine my embarrassment now when I'm going to be speaking Great Barrington in a couple of nights, and I'm going to have to tell the audience we're at a crossroads in the history of American politics, and it's been growing for 50 years. Both parties are kind of consumed with a sense of nostalgia for a past that existed but can't be brought back. The Democrats are nostalgic for the economy of the 1950s, the concentration of big businesses working in lockstep with huge labor unions, and also they're nostalgic for the days when big government programs seemed an unalloyed good. The Republicans are nostalgic for the society of the 1950s, where father knew best, homosexuality hadn't been invented yet, and we all had picnics on the 4th of July. And it seems to me that Trump is the ultimate expression of that sort of nostalgia, only he packages it in a very, very modern way. I mean, I think he's the first candidate of the too much information age.
So who are the Bernieites? Have you thought about that at all?
Oh, sure. In fact, I asked Hillary about it. I asked Hillary the following question. You know, back in, I guess it was in Iowa, they were running these ads which showed her at various stages of her life advocating for children. And there was a very fetching photo of her. It looked like she was on a beach somewhere, and she was kind of had her head turned toward the camera, and she was looking very proud. And I said to her, you know, I was around back in those days when you were that age. I was about the same age as you. And that young woman would have been a Bernie supporter. And she said, no, no, no. I said, well, you were a McGovern supporter. And she said, yeah, I guess you're right. And I said to her, what would you say to that young woman? What argument could you make to that young woman not to be a Bernie supporter? And she thought about it for a sec, and she said, well, I wouldn't want her to lose her idealism, but she's going to have to learn that you have to make compromises for the public good.
Her ability to take a shot is just legendary, you know, just keep moving. What's that about?
Well, she's tough, and she knows who she is, and she knows what she believes. By the way, I think that her religion has an awful lot to do with this. She's
really
a Methodist, and she grew up inculcated with the belief that if you want to go to heaven, you had to do good works. You always have to be improving the community for others. In fact, in that same interview, I asked her a rather provocative question. I said, I've known you guys for a long time, and here's what mystifies me about your marriage. And I could see her kind of tensing up. And I said, you're a Methodist and he's a Baptist. How does that work? And she said, well, you know, there are a lot of jokes about that. I said, I know. Tell me a few. And she said, not on your life. But, you know, Baptists are famously forgiven, self-forgiving. You know, all they have to do is reassert, you know, say that they've been wrong, reassert their allegiance to Jesus and be reborn again. Methodists, not so much. Methodists, you got to go out and build houses in the community, or, you know, shovel dirt before you can get back in God's good graces.
You know, Joe Klein, I just saw the film Wiener. Have you seen that yet?
No, I haven't. I'd love to see it. I knew Anthony back when, and I know Huma.
I have to say, I haven't seen anything better in a long, long time. I just thought it was superb, really great. Not since The Candidate with Robert Redford have I thought anything, you know, really hit the mark this way. But I thought about the Clintons as a result of this and this relationship between this man and this woman. And you skirted around it a little bit. What can you tell us?
About?
What it takes to get along between two public figures like that.
Well, you know, no one is ever going to know the inside of their marriage. You know, I can speculate about characters like them fictionally, But the closest I ever came was during Lewinsky, which was a couple of years after Primary Colors was published. And I was working for The New Yorker then, and I made it known immediately in The New Yorker that I thought that this was nonsense, not worthy of our attention. And yeah, so he messed around with an intern. What else was new? And my editor at The New Yorker, Tina Brown, said to me, I want you to do a piece about the marriage. And I said to her, fine, but you got to know my theory is that there really is a marriage there. So she said, prove it. And I contacted Hillary through an intermediary, through one of her best friends, and I said, I have this assignment, and you know that I believe that you have a marriage, so will you open up your friends to talk to me about it? And she agreed. And the most important story came from the late Diane Blair, who was Hillary's best friend. And Blair was in the White House one day, and she was having tea with Hillary. And Bill came in, and Bill started arguing with Hillary about a small point of different policy difference on an environmental issue. And the two of them started going at it, and they were screaming at each other. And Diane Blair said, I felt that I wanted to crawl underneath the couch. I thought it might come to blows. And at that very moment, he takes Hillary by the face, kisses her on the lips, turns to Diane and says, isn't she fabulous?
Fantastic. So there are rumors, of course, always, that he's a womanizer and continues to be a womanizer.
Oh, I think it's undoubtedly true that he's a womanizer.
So,
or was a womanizer. I mean, the guy's pushing 70 at this point. He's had two open heart surgeries. You know, if he's still a womanizer, God bless.
Maybe that's why he had two open heart surgeries.
It may well be.
Anyway, what's going to happen in this election?
I don't know. You know, this is my 11th one of these.
Right.
God help me. And I don't make predictions. I stopped making predictions a long time ago. But I will say that it is possible that Trump could win. And that seems so strange because, you know, this is a contest between the best prepared person in my lifetime for the presidency, Hillary Clinton, and the worst prepared person, Donald Trump, who also clearly does not have a presidential temperament. And yet he strikes a chord with the folks because he gives the appearance of honesty, even when he's being totally obnoxious, and he gets away with it. That's why I said he's the, you know, American people are more comfortable with reality TV than they are with reality. Reality, especially in politics these days, is so complicated and so subtle. I mean, people like me have to learn about things like cyber warfare and then explain it? My God, it's near impossible. Reality TV is, you know, far more accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, you know, reality TV is really the signal invention of the too much information age. So this is a guy who really knows how to communicate. He has also picked off the issues on both the conservative and liberal side that working class Americans can identify with. They're scared about losing jobs overseas. They're scared about immigration. They don't want to have entitlements like Social Security and Medicare touched by the government. They want to continue those. They don't care all that much about unisex bathrooms. And when you look at where he stands on all of these very high profile issues, he is where that constituency is. And the question is going to be how nimble she will be in doing this. You know, I think her initial strategy of not responding to his personal attacks is probably very wise. And I think that the other part of the strategy, which is to take the callous things he's said that affect the lives of real people, like his desire to make money off of the housing crash, I think that those, when it comes really time to get serious in the fall, those things may make a difference. But still, I mean, this is the most intimate office we have, President of the United States. The president lives in your house. And it's my theory that the presidential election is almost always about character, not policy. And that character is put on display in the three debates and we get to see and we get to judge, and it's a gut-level judgment, which person we want to have living in our house for the next 4 years.
So Bill Clinton, it seems to me, is a guy who retires from the presidency, if not the most popular, right up there of all presidents. So Trump has to defame him. It's the only way, because they're going to put him out on the campaign trail. And basically, now he's going around with Rush Limbaugh, you talked about before, suggesting he was a rapist. Is that just to bring him down?
I don't know what it is. I don't know that. I think that Trump has learned from the experience that when he attacks someone wildly and foolishly, it doesn't hurt him.
Not at all.
So why not do it? If he can succeed with conservative voters by attacking Megyn Kelly's menstrual cycle, you know, anything goes, right?
Right. Joe Klein, what happens to the Republican Party, assuming, let's try it this way, the Republicans lose, and you see this thing where they're talking about reassembling the rules, changing the rules around. So is this the end of the Republican Party?
Well, no one can say that, but I think the Republican Party, as we've known it, already has lost. I mean, the Republican Party, as we've known it for the last 20, 25 years, was an increasingly conservative party. And yet everything that those people say, the Paul Ryans of this world, believe, has been overturned by Donald Trump. I mean, conservatives are free traders. Conservatives want lower taxes on the wealthy. Trump recently said that he didn't. Conservatives want to reform, that is, cut back on Social Security and Medicare. Trump is against that. I mean, I think that right now, and, you know, I'm friendly with a number of very smart, intellectual conservatives, the sort of people who are not backing Trump, and they're devastated. They don't, you know, the things that they believed in, you know, have been rejected by their own constituency. Here's another one. Neoconservatives, the people who are always plumping for war in the Middle East, they have been entirely rejected by the Republican constituency. And Trump famously, you know, said that George W. Bush lied about the war in Iraq and that it was a big mistake and that we spent $4 trillion needlessly in the region. And so, you know, whatever emerges from this, there's going to be, you know, I think is going to be different from what we've seen, because it already is. I mean, the things that Republicans had been running on the presidential level simply do not work.
So following from that, what happened to the Bushes in this?
Well, the Bushes were the old school. You know, I feel very fondly about the Bushes, very kindly toward them. I think that George H.W. Bush ran the very best foreign policy of any administration in my lifetime. And Jeb Bush is someone I've also known for a while, and I thought that his policy formulations in areas like education and government reform were the most sophisticated, the best I'd seen. But he was still playing by those old, by the old rules, by the old industrial age, you know, political rules, rather than the too much information age rules. And the too much information age, your opponent can say that you have low energy, and unless you demonstrate otherwise, you're tattooed.
I want to go back to Bernie Sanders for a moment. Is it possible that he has it in him to lose the election for Hillary?
He can hurt. He's hurting her already. And the most important thing that he has to do, if he doesn't want Donald Trump to be president, is going to be to convince his constituents, the really feel-the-burn folks, that it's in their best interests to elect Hillary at this point. You know, a lot of them are going to say, well, let's just burn it all down. There's a pun.
Yes, but that's right. You're exactly on the money. You're exactly on the money, Joe Klein. I have to tell you, you and I, you talked about being on the peace marches. I was there, too. And I remember there were always these guys from the extreme, by the way, I voted for Bernie, but from the extreme left who were saying, got to tear it all down before we can have anything good. So good, let Trump win.
Right. No, I remember fighting. I worked for the underground press in Boston at the dawn of the 1970s. And I remember when Nixon started bombing Hanoi and Haiphong. The two underground papers, which were the Real Paper, which I worked for in the Boston Phoenix, decided to have a joint front page condemning this and give the proceeds of those issues to the Vietnamese people. And, you know, the fight was between those of us who wanted to send medical supplies and the crazy lefties who wanted to send guns. I mean, those people were nuts. And the world that they envision, the economic system that they envision, does not comport with human, you know, human behavior. It doesn't. I mean, government, you know, I'm a strong believer in capitalism. I think it's created, it's done more to reduce poverty than any other economic system in the history of the world by a lot. I do believe it has to be controlled by the government.
Yep.
I believe that there are excesses. But I celebrate, I mean, and even if you have to have an occasional obnoxious Donald Trump, you know, the system is worth it, right? You know, if he can make $1 gazillion selling his name to Asian investors and who then put his name on buildings, then, you know, good for him. But we need to be able to tax him. We need to be able to regulate big business activities. We need to be able to take care of those who are kind of tossed aside in the creative destruction of capitalism. But in the end, government isn't going to be the engine of prosperity. You know, capitalism is.
Joe Klein, you are, of course, a first-rate journalist. We all know that. How's the press doing these days?
I don't think we're doing very well this year. I think that we're doing pretty badly this year. And in fact, this is one of the worst I've seen, in part because of the fact that Trump, I mean, ratings for CNN are up 170% or something like that. And they found that if, and MSNBC, and to a lesser extent Fox, found that the more you put Trump on the air, you know, the more people watch. It is, you know, like watching a traffic accident.
So what would you do, Joe Klein, if you were the head of, knowing that, you know, that 170% or whatever counts for ads and everything else, would you do the same thing or be fired? What would you do?
Well, I wouldn't do the same thing. And I would allow my journalists to be more critical of Trump. And, you know, you're beginning to see it a little bit. I was watching Chuck Todd on Meet the Press, and he was speaking freely about the fact that Donald Trump doesn't know anything, that his positions on issues are untenable and ill-informed or uninformed. But where was this before? I mean, I've gotten into trouble twice on TV this year by saying that, you know, this guy is a con man. You know, and I was on Morning Joe and I said that Trump was acting out of his lizard brain and appealing to the lizard brains of his constituents. And you know that we all have a lizard brain. It is the primordial brain that we came with that's at the root of, the top of our spinal cord that controls things like fight or flight and hunger and sex. And, you know, what Trump is appealing to isn't the, you know, frontal cortex of his voters. He's appealing to their most primal instincts.
You know, every time I say this on the air, boy, do I get hit. But are the American people prepared to be voting in a Democratic election? Do they know enough?
Well, I don't think they do. And that's another thing that's happened over the last 50, 60 years. And it gives me the opportunity to talk about my most recent book, Charlie Mike. Because, as I said to you earlier, I can't opine about things unless I'm there, unless I see them. And so I had to go to Iraq and Afghanistan and embed with our troops. And especially after Petraeus took over and counterinsurgency took over, what our troops were doing overseas is something different from what American troops have ever done before. And that is they were governing towns. And I kept on going back to this same town in Afghanistan and watched a succession of 30-year-old captains essentially be mayors of the town. And they were doing things that had never been done before. I mean, they would have their troops crowdsource, you know, the people of the town and ask them what they needed because we had public works funds available to them. And then they would have to sell the ideas that the people wanted to the local shura, the town council, which was inevitably corrupt. And I remember one day watching a American captain named Jeremiah Ellis in the town of Sanjuray in Afghanistan convincing a local farmer to allow American troops to sit on top of his roof so that they could guard the local school. And I said to myself, if this guy can do this here, under fire, in a different language, he can come home and run for governor of Iowa, which is where he came from. And when I would come home in between these trips to Iraq and Afghanistan, I would see that the image of American veterans that was being portrayed by my colleagues in the media was very different from the impression that I had of them. You know, the image that you hear about, and I'm sure you've done more than a few shows about this, is that they're basket cases, they're suicidal, they're living under highway bridges, they're drug addicts, they beat their wives, you know, they're suffering from post-traumatic stress, all of which is true, but only part of the story. And in fact, and here's where we go back into the relationship with politics. One of the things I've learned about post-traumatic stress is that it isn't just what they saw and did over there. It is a consequence of losing what they had over there, which is this tremendous sense of community, a sense of purpose, a sense that their lives were important, that they had to pay attention, they wanted to pay attention, and that they were crushed when their brothers and sisters, they call each other brother and sister, you know, were wounded in any way. And it made me, and then they come home, and we ask nothing of them because we ask nothing of ourselves. There are polls that show that upwards of 90% of returning veterans want to continue to serve in their communities, which is, I think, quite a bit different from the rest of us who have kind of lost the habits of citizenship in this long period of relative peace and prosperity that we've had. And I think that we've been trying to conduct this experiment of doing democracy without citizens. And so the reason why I wrote Charlie Mike, which is about these two spectacular young men who are linked by a tragedy, and they start great public service organizations back home. The reason why I wrote the book was because I believe that the rest of us can learn something from the values and training that the military has. I think that these folks are absolutely, you know, the ideal citizens. They all volunteered to serve our country, many of them on September 12, 2001. So, and I think that when you look at the Trump phenomenon and you look at the people who are voting for him as a kick or because he talks like us about Muslims, which people have told me, or he's magically going to provide jobs, which he isn't, that's the exact opposite from these kids who I watched working and protecting in wars that I thought were questionable in Iraq and Afghanistan.
So you were out there during Vietnam on the line and all. So have things changed or have you changed?
Oh, I think that the military has changed remarkably. You know, the very act of being a volunteer organization, the fact that there's no draft, you know, changes things amazingly. But I don't think that the stupidity of our leaders has changed. You know, going to war in Vietnam because we saw it as part of an international communist conspiracy. We thought, you know, China was going to, you know, it was a Chinese lapdog when the Vietnamese have been fighting the Chinese for 2,000 years. And then going, having a president who didn't know the difference between a Sunni and a Shiite, going to war in Iraq, which wasn't even a country, which isn't a country. You can't blame the stupidity of the government on the troops. But I do believe that the troops themselves are really different now. And you find a fair number in the officer corps who are either classics majors or minors, who know all about citizenship from the things that they've read about ancient Greece. It is extraordinary. The main character in Charlie Mike, a good fellow by the name of Eric Reitens, who is now running for governor of Missouri as a Republican, said to me, look, I'll do this. I'll let you interview me as much as you want, but first you have to read the Odyssey. And I said, why? He said, well, it was the first book ever written about a veteran coming home.
Wow. So in your lifetime, Joe Klein, who has been, to your mind, the most iconic president?
You know, it's hard to see icons.
Okay.
when the curtain has been drawn on the Wizard of Oz, right?
Right.
you know, I'm just finishing reading David McCulloch's book about Harry Truman, and boy, does he seem iconic, although at the time, he seemed, you know, like a haberdasher.
I remember standing, going to the movies, and they'd throw the news reels, and the audience would boo as one.
Yes.
When Harry's...
And Eisenhower, who seemed, a senile old fool, also...
Yes.
Was, you know, he was the last person who saw the military-industrial complex very clearly, and the dangers of that. You know, I don't know that we've had an iconic president. The ones who seem the most iconic are the ones who were killed. John Kennedy, who knows what would have happened with him. If you look at it rationally, he made some really stupid decisions, but he had the highest sustained approval ratings, and he defined a generation. I'm sure that I wouldn't have gone off, and maybe you wouldn't have gone off, to march for civil rights and against the war if it hadn't been for the image of him. Bobby Kennedy, to me, was a really important figure. And, you know, there was an iconic night, speaking of iconic things, the night that Martin Luther King was assassinated. And Bobby was scheduled to go into the ghetto in Indianapolis, and the local police chief told him not to go in, that they couldn't protect him. And he goes in, and his speechwriter, Adam Walensky, hands him some notes, and he rejects the notes. He's just going to speak off the cuff. And you can hear this speech. You know, you could get it on YouTube. You could see it on YouTube. He speaks for no more than 5 minutes, and he quotes Aeschylus. He tells the crowd, first of all, that Martin Luther King has been killed. And then he quotes the Greek poet Aeschylus, and he calms them. Indianapolis is the only one of the 140 largest cities in the country not to have riots that night because of what he did there. Nowadays, they would have never let him go into that crowd if it hadn't been market tested in advance. And Aeschylus, Aeschahu, you're going to talk to these barely educated, infuriated people about a Greek poet? That kind of spontaneity and character is what has been drained from American politics during the 47 years that I've done this.
So let's talk about redemption. I hate to go here because I think you're going to get mad at me. But Bobby Kennedy, I'm old enough to remember him sitting there at Joe McCarthy's side. I remember, you know, his arguments with Eleanor Roosevelt. And I remember some of the things which really were not nice. So I'm just simply asking you, what do you make of his transformation? I started by using the word iconic, and I'm going to use it now, from, you know, a guy who, you know, was McCarthy's guy to this liberal icon.
Well, first of all, he wasn't all that liberal. His urban policy was very much unlike the welfare state that liberals have imposed on the poor and have done great damage over the years. But the fact is that he grew. He learned. You know, we can't foreclose that possibility from our politicians. I was speaking before about how Hillary learned the military. I'm sure that she didn't have that sort of sensitivity when she was the first lady, and I'm sure the military hated her for that. I mean, it was notorious in those days. But, you know, just as we can't foreclose the possibility that we're going to learn things, that we're going to change our positions on issues, you know, it's a good thing when a politician grows and learns and it isn't done for simply political reasons. When it's done, when the positions that they arrive at are positions that aren't all that popular or that are risky, then it makes a difference.
So I want to go back because you've just talked about Hillary, and I think a lot of people are going to be very interested in this joke line, to the fact that you're going to have assuming she wins, you'll have a new president, but you'll also have an old president living in the White House. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, I'm not going to assume that she wins.
No, I'm just saying, for the sake of the argument now, she wins.
Yeah. But I think that, you know, that in many ways, she learned how to be a valuable resource to him over time. I mean, they both learned the lesson that you don't put the other, you don't put the spouse in charge of things the way she was put in charge of health care. But the spouse can be used very, very effectively to move opinion. And, you know, I was with Hillary in 1995 in South Asia. It was her first first overseas trip after the healthcare disaster. And we go to Pakistan. It's our first stop. And we're all kind of jet lagged. And the first stop is this school for young women. And these spectacular young women start talking about how they want to be doctors and lawyers and professionals of other sorts, but they can't be because of the culture in, you know, the Islamic culture that had overtaken Pakistan. And I watched her, that in those moments, I watched her learn and that she had a new mission, that her mission was to promote, you know, promote equality for women and better treatment for children, which was a very appropriate mission for a spouse. I think in Bill's case, you know, he can be used very well overseas, and he might even be a good special envoy to negotiate something like the Middle East. I remember talking to Obama 2 weeks before Obama was elected, and we were talking about Afghanistan and Pakistan, and I said, you think you'd ever send Bill over there to, you know, to do that? And he thought it was an interesting idea, but then he had a better idea, which was to make her Secretary of State. So, you know, I think there are a lot of things that Bill Clinton can do, and there are going to be a lot of ways in which he can really screw things up. But you gotta hope that they learned from the lessons of his administration about what the limits are, you know, for spousal activity.
But some of that's going to rely, Joe Klein, on self-discipline, obviously, on his
Well,
part.
She's disciplined as hell.
Yeah, no, we know about her. I'm talking about him. I remember the day, I'm sure you do too, that the president, Obama, his ratings were not doing that well. He invites Bill Clinton to come and talk to the press corps. Remember that? And he stands up there, and he won't shut up. He won't stop. The president turns around and walks away, walks out of the briefing session, yes, and lets Bill go on. I thought that was fascinating.
Yes, and I don't think that she would ever allow that to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that she spent a lifetime of telling him to shut up.
So what is it like to be really a world famous author?
I don't know.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. Well, I mean, what are you feeling? You've achieved this great presence in journalism. The book that you wrote, The Primary Colors, you know, is on everybody's shelf. The new book, I'm sure, will do extremely well. What is it? And you're invited on all these great television shows. What, in fact, does that feel like? You have any sense of what your importance is to the outside viewer? Do you feel it on the inside?
Well, I'm Jewish.
Me too.
And so there's always the prophet Jeremiah somewhere in my head screaming at me if I start getting to feel too big.
Right, right.
You know, the mistakes that I've made as a journalist have always been when I didn't go out and do the work, when I had a clever thought or opinion and wrote it before I thought it through. And so, you know, I'm coming to the end of my journalism now. I'm not going to do another presidential campaign. You know, and I feel very satisfied with the life that I've led. I mean, it's really been a fascinating, wonderful life. But I also feel very satisfied doing what I'm doing right now, which is looking out the window at the lawn and the flowers that are just starting to come up on at our house on Cape Cod, and thinking about my kids, staring right now at a height chart of my granddaughters. And it's not, it used to be a part of the door frame in the kitchen, but we pulled it out and put a bow on it, and we're going to give it to them this weekend because they're moving to Texas. And, you know, the thought of that is every bit as gratifying as anything I've ever done, you know, professionally. You got to say that. I didn't always feel that way, but as I grow older, friends become more important, family becomes more important. And not getting on planes becomes more important.
So if you had advice to those coming up, would you say take chances who want to do what you're doing?
Oh, absolutely. You got to take chances. You really do have to take chances if you want to do this well. And the biggest chance that you have to take is the ability to try and understand the positions of people with whom you absolutely disagree.
Are you good at that?
I've gotten better. I've gotten better.
I've heard it in our conversation today, and you've been very generous with your time, but I've heard it when you talk about capitalism and you talk about the people you like and the people who have impressed you. It's obvious that you've been thinking about them, about what they're thinking.
Let me give you another tough one, abortion.
Sure.
I mean, it was really easy and to be in favor of choice back when the Supreme Court decision came down in 1973. But over the last 40 years, there has been a lot of improvement in neonatal technology. And I've seen 3D, you know, pictures of my grandchildren at 12 weeks. And you can't tell me that that isn't a human being. I don't know where I stand on abortion at this point, but I do know that what we're doing is that these are human beings in there. And it becomes a much, much, much more difficult issue to talk or think about when you see it as clearly as we can now because of the technology.
I've loved talking to Joe Klein today. Joe, I've done many, many interviews, probably thousands, and this is really at the top of the list. I just so thank you for giving us all this time. I want to remind everybody that we've been in conversation today with journalist, author, and columnist Joe Klein. Joe, thanks so much for joining us. So appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks, Alan. I'm glad. I hope this experience was better than our first experience together.
You bet.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.